From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Marilyn Morning. Maryland is getting $15 million from the Federal Education Department to expand access to pre-kindergarten programs. How many four-year-olds will benefit from this money? We ask Rolf Grafwalder, who heads early childhood development efforts in the State Department of Education. Then Carla Hayden, CEO of the Enoch Pratt Free Library, suggests books worth curling up with these cold winter nights. Plus, tis the season for A Christmas Carol. Theater critic J. Wen Russick brings us her review of Chesapeake Shakespeare Company's take on the holiday classic. And Kathy Beauchesne is trying to keep the art of handmade wooden basketry alive in Maryland. We talk with her about what a basket can tell us about our past. First, the news.
I'm Nathan Sterner, and if you were listening to Maryland Morning Live, I'd be bringing you the latest Maryland news right about now. You can catch the live show Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 9 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 FM in Ocean City, and online at WYPR.org. For now, you're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast. Thanks for downloading us. Let's get the show underway.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Maryland is getting $15 million from the federal government to expand access to its pre-kindergarten programs. Half of the 36 states that competed for the preschool development grants got them, a total of $226 million nationwide, focused on making pre-K available to more four-year-olds. The money comes to Maryland on top of the much smaller appropriation, $4.3 million, which Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown pushed through the General Assembly in its 2014 session. Adding the state and federal funds together, even if each is repeated for the next 4 years, as ground rules say they could be, would not reach the likely cost of universal pre-K, that is, ensuring that every four-year-old in Maryland has access to a program that makes them fully ready for kindergarten. So, where do things stand with pre-K in Maryland? It was an issue in the political campaign for governor this fall. What happens now? We've invited Rolf Grafwalder to discuss that with us. He's the assistant superintendent in the Division of Early Childhood Development in the Maryland State Department of Education. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Sheila.
Before we talk about the future, let's talk about where we are now. When you and I spoke almost 2 years ago, you told us that about 37% of four-year-olds from economically disadvantaged backgrounds were in pre-K in Maryland then. What is the picture this fall?
Well, the number of children that are in our public school pre-kindergarten program hasn't changed dramatically over the last 2 years. So the 37% are still true that, 26,500 four-year-olds come to our public schools, are enrolled in half-day or full-day pre-kindergarten programs. What this state expansion did, it included local school systems expansion. That means additional classrooms in public schools, as well as classrooms in high-quality community-based programs that integrate their pre-kindergarten component into the regular day of their full-day program. That means, starting at 7 in the morning until about 6 in the evening, and that pre-kindergarten component of 2.5 hours or 6.5 hours is built in. So it's a strong educational program for those four-year-olds in those settings. And this pre-kindergarten expansion is building on that.
The federal money
is building on the state funds that we received earlier this year, and expands the number of children having access to pre-kindergarten programs, either at the public schools or at these community-based programs.
And so it sounds like of late there's actually been that most of the expansion has been not in public school buildings, but in community-based buildings.
Yeah, and it has a lot to do with the fact that some of those four-year-olds are already enrolled in some of these programs. And then there's another aspect for local schools. It's a space issue to some extent in having additional classrooms available for pre-kindergartners. And we just want to make sure at the state level that these community-based programs have a good track record in terms of quality, offering programs that can maintain a high-quality learning environment for their children, have a certified teacher in the classroom, and meet some other quality standards and criteria that are important for young children's learning.
When does the federal money actually get to Maryland?
Well, the grant is set up for next year in January, so that we are working toward ramping up this grant program so that 3,000 additional children have access to pre-kindergarten classrooms by September of next year. And so it starts as early as January 1st.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Rolf Grafwalner, Assistant State Superintendent of the Division of Early Childhood Development in the Maryland State Department of Education. We're talking about the grant that Maryland received last week for $15 million to put toward expanding pre-K programs. That federal money, how will it be distributed around the state?
So what we had to do as part of this application is to identify so-called sub-grantees. That means those programs that express an interest in enrolling four-year-olds into the schools and early childhood programs. And so we received more requests than we could accommodate. We have 18 jurisdictions provide some kind of expansion across the state, and we're primarily focusing in on low-income neighborhoods. We have a number of four-year-olds who currently have not access to pre-kindergarten, and we want to make sure that they have the ability to be enrolled by next year, by next school year. I think I need to mention the fact that in our existing pre-kindergarten program in public schools, the families that are eligible for free and reduced meals, that's sort of a common proxy for poverty, have access to a pre-kindergarten slot in the public school. That has been in place since 2007. What this federal money does, it expands the number of families having access to it by increasing the income eligibility.
I've had the impression from some of the news articles I've read that there have been places under the existing guidelines where there was more demand than there were slots for mm-hmm. kids. By next fall, for the income levels that we're talking about, will there be enough slots for every four-year-old who's eligible?
That's an excellent question because, I mean, we always have in some jurisdictions more families that are interested in having their four-year-olds enrolled in a public school, and they get to be put on a wait list unless their income is low enough to qualify. And that's always a frustrating experience for families, not being able to have access to that. Now, what we can do, what the local school systems can do, is to coordinate that kind of enrollment for next year and to inform families about the other option, that there might be community-based programs available that can enroll them, you know, and provide them a free access to pre-kindergarten services. So that's really helpful for families, especially those that are working full-time or you have two wage earners who need to have a child enrolled in the morning and in the late afternoon hours, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and then have that educational component built in. So that's a real plus for the families who would like to have their children have a high-quality early learning opportunity.
As I mentioned, the concept of universal pre-K became a point of conversation during the gubernatorial campaign, and candidate Larry Hogan, now governor-elect Hogan, said he had no objection to pre-K, but basically didn't think Maryland could afford universal pre-K. Is there anything we've talked about that actually gets us to universal pre-K in Maryland?
Well, in our application that we submitted to the U.S. Department of Education, which funds this pre-kindergarten expansion, we made it very clear that this is a cornerstone to ramping up the access to pre-kindergarten in Maryland beyond just the low-income group. We're bringing in income groups that in the past had no access to high-quality programs because the tuition costs, in most cases, are way too high and don't match their incomes. If you are the family with income, household income of $50,000, there's no way you can support or finance an early childhood education program at $10,000 a year in tuition. Mm-hmm. So many of those families in the lower middle class category really had no way to find access to these programs. And that's what this expansion really is trying to do, is to bring in more families that didn't have access in the past to have these this opportunity. And of course, it's a great opportunity for young children before they start their public school experience in kindergarten to have access to that program. And what it is, it's an investment up front. You know, if you have more children coming in to kindergarten better prepared, you have less of a need for public schools to sort of make up the deficit that we see in some of the children in terms of special ed services, in terms of support services for English language learners, in terms of some distraction that might be occurring in terms of family upheavals. Some of these things are being addressed early on, and so it's an investment up front for better outcomes later in school life.
Was the existence of the $4.3 million the legislation that looked to $4.3 million in the Maryland budget each year, was that a key part of Maryland persuading the federal government to give it the $15 million?
Yeah, that certainly helped, because in the way this worked is that the states received additional points in the competition for the federal grant award if they were investing themselves with state funds. And so this was very critical in terms of being ahead the curve in the competition against all these other states that were submitting grant applications.
Well, is it clear, and I'm not trying to make you a spokesman for the federal government, but is it clear that if Maryland were to cut back on its $4 million, that might endanger repeating the federal grant?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is one aspect that it would endanger the grant, but the $4.3 million have been written into the law as something that would continue, and for the governor to put it into the budget. And so that's sort of codified in the Pre-Kindergarten Expansion Act that the legislature passed earlier this year.
Something to watch for in the budget.
Yeah, we expect it to be in there because it is something that's in the law.
I'm grateful to you for talking us through it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Ralph Graf-Wallner. He's Assistant State Superintendent of the Division of Early Childhood Development at the Maryland State Department of Education. We have more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. More of this interview there, too. I'm Sheila Cast, ahead on Maryland Morning. Winter Book Picks. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Thanks for listening.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us this morning. Carla Hayden joins us as well. She's, of course, the director of the Enoch Pratt Free Library here in Baltimore and stops by from time to time to recommend some great reading. So we've got some holiday books on the list. How you doing, Carla?
Fine, and this is a great time of year to get a wonderful book because, you know, the weather's going to change and the first snowflakes are going to come down and you're going to have wonderful books to just curl up with.
Yeah, so we got some curling up books.
This is great.
So you're starting with a few books that that take place or are about World War II. The first is a book that won the Man Booker Prize called The Narrow Road to the Deep North. It's a novel by Richard Flanagan.
And it's the life story, really, of a young man who goes into the war, and he's thinking one way. He's a surgeon. And he has all of these wonderful ideas about saving humanity. And then before he goes, he has an affair with his uncle's wife. So that's kind of haunting him, but he sees redemption in going to war. And then he's captured. And he becomes a Japanese prisoner of war and goes to the camp. And you know, there's a popular movie that's out now that kind of talks about that type of experience. And so this is about his struggle and then getting out and coming back. And he's still concerned about the affair, and he still has that to deal with, and all of the family pressures. And what is it like being a prisoner of war in a very brutal environment? And how do you survive?
Yeah. So that's an interesting.
So that's one, and it's so well written. And in fact, one of the reviewers said that after page 70, be prepared to cancel the rest of your life. There is no stopping till the end. So this is one of those books when you hear the weather forecast and there's going to be a big snowstorm.
This is the one.
Get this book out.
All right.
Get to 70.
And be forewarned. After page 70, you're on your own. Okay, that's The Narrow Road to the Deep North by Richard Flanagan, winner of the Man Booker Prize. And the next one you bought is the one that won the National Book Award. This is by Phil Kay. It's called Redeployment. This is a series of stories about folks in the military in more recent conflicts.
And what's interesting about this book is it reads like nonfiction, but it's fiction. And it's all about what happens when you are on the front lines and you are, for instance, a person who has faith in humanity and God and all of these things, and then you have the brutality of war and the conflicts. And so you had a soldier who had to shoot dogs because the dogs were eating human corpses. And how do you see those types of things, participate that, and then go back to your life in suburbia?
Yeah. And of course, there are, as you say, an awful lot of books. There's first-person accounts of people's experience in Iraq and people's experiences in Afghanistan.
Right.
But this, and this kind of sounds like it would be that, but these are fictional accounts.
They're fictional
but
accounts.
Based on an awful
real
lot of real
experiences.
Experience.
And so you have a chaplain who has this, of course, deep faith, but this understanding of Christianity and how do you provide solace to people who are seeing such atrocities and going through it. So the stories, they're short stories, but they have impact and they stay with you.
All right, Redeployment by Phil Clay, the winner of the National Book Award on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. My guest, Dr. Carla Hayden from the Enoch Pratt Library. We're recommending some books perhaps for holiday giving or for curling up if we get a storm or two. This next one is interesting. This is nonfiction. It's called When Books Went to War, The Stories That Helped Us Win World War II. It's by Molly Guptill Manning. And this is about publishers' efforts to help the war effort in World War II.
And this is where the paperback books that we enjoy today really came into fruition and were used as not only comfort for the troops, but also as a way to combat what was happening in terms of book banning, and over a million books were burned at the time. And people were very outraged, and I have to put in a plug for librarians. They helped lead this at the time, to send free books to the troops. And they got 20 million hardcover donations and then many more paperbacks. And the stories that people tell about how The Great Gatsby, for instance, became one of the most popular books, and it elevated Great Gatsby to what we know today. The author of A Tree Grows in Brooklyn talks about how her book was just sitting there and now it's a national icon. And so this story is about how the soldiers related to the books that they were given and what it did for them to be in a foxhole and reading and having these inspirational stories.
Yeah,
to tell.
And the books were actually, many of them were produced specifically to fit in the pockets
right.
of the soldiers.
Pocket books.
Yeah, great picture on the cover here
right.
of a guy who's in camouflage in a foxhole, and he's reading a book that's teeny. But it's teeny because he's got all his other stuff
pocket
to carry.
Books,
and,
right.
it literally fits in his pockets. This is a fascinating
It's wonderful
subject.
Reading, yeah. And it makes you think. And then there's a list also of all of the books that were available. And the Penguin Publishing Company was really involved in that as well.
Yeah, and of course, so, how it changed so dramatically, the publishing industry, you know, which continues to change to this day.
Right.
So When Books Went to War, the stories that helped us win World War II
by
Molly Manning.
A book in a different way.
Yeah. Here's another one called Station 11. It's a novel by Emily St. John Mandel. What's this one about?
Oh, it's almost hard to describe. It's about a Hollywood star who has a heart attack on stage during a production of King Lear, and someone in the audience jumps to his aid, and then a child actress is there, and she watches as he performs CPR on the actor, who then dies. But then a flu begins to spread, and hospitals are flooded, and it turns into this futuristic story. 15 years later, the child actress is traveling with the small troupe. It's fantasy, it's reality. It is on every best book list for 2014.
Yeah.
And this is one where you just have to start getting your covers and your socks and all of that and get cozied up, because it's going to take you from here to there and all around. And it's just a beautiful story, beautifully written. And if you like fantasy and you like suspense, this is the novel for you.
That's
so it's on every best book list.
It's Station 11. It's a novel by Emily St. John Mandel. This other one is a book I've heard about but don't know much about it. Actually, it's called The Book of Strange New Things. It's by Michael Faber. He wrote a book called Crimson Petal and the White, which got some recognition. But The Book of Strange New Things, what's that about?
And this is another book that is bending different types of genres. It starts with a man of faith, Peter, who's called to the mission of a lifetime. He thinks he's going to be in galaxies far away from his wife. He is overseeing a kind of thing like Interstellar, when you think about that movie. And they're going away. He comes back, and he has letters back to his wife. And things are happening at home. Typhoons, earthquakes are destroying the earth. And her faith begins to falter, and then suddenly they are together again, and you have to really spend some time with it.
So you got to stick with this one, yeah.
But the language, again, takes you through it, and you want to find out what's going on. And it is full of strange new things, because they're exploring new worlds.
All right, The Book of Strange New Things by Michael Faber. We've got a couple of how-tos here.
And also, that Book of Strange New Things is also on every list of the best books for 2014.
So
you have to do that. So that's great. For the real one. Now, to get really down to earth, though, How to Be a Victorian.
Yes, of all the how-to guides
this
that you could bring, Carla, you're telling us how to be a Victorian, all right? Just, you know, just what we need, period dentistry.
Well, it's good to pair with DVDs of Downton Abbey, or a book that was turned into a movie, with a gift card to something that is a period movie, because it's really a delightful tour through Victorian life, and it's taking you behind the scenes of what you have, for instance, waking up to a knocker upper man who goes around and knocks on the window to wake you up, and also how to lace into a corset after calisthenics, and also...
And what guy or gal can't leave the gym without knowing that?
That's and right. Also slipping opium to the little ones. And that was something the Victorians did for what they called, and this is a quote, a evening of love, consideration, control, and pleasure.
There you go.
And so
Victorians were not that okay of describing an opium den.
But it's really fun. It has all kinds of illustrations, and it's a good book. And speaking of fun.
Well, hold on. Let me just tell folks this title, if you're interested. How to Be a Victorian, a Dawn to Dusk Guide to Victorian Life. It's by Ruth Goodman, Ruth Goodman. You know, the first time I went to London years and years and years ago, I checked into the hotel and the lady behind the counter said, "What time would you like to be knocked up in the morning?"
That's
and I
right.
Thought, well, isn't that what a friendly country this is?
That's right. Well, there were people that would actually knock you up, and that's what it was, and that's where it came from.
Now, speaking of knockups here, here's one called The Andy Cohen Diaries, A Deep Look at a Shallow Year. Andy Cohen is a big hit, evidently, on Bravo Network.
Well,
I don't know much about him, I gotta
confess. He's a TV producer. He's the host of a show that captures a lot of gossip and pop culture called Watch What Happens Live. He is just a fun person. And he loves to go out in New York. He loves New York, and he drops names, and he is really the creator of all of the Real Housewives.
Because there's a whole bunch of those. There's like Atlanta and New Jersey. And
he controls that. He loves his mom, and she's a part of the show that he has at evening. But he is really just fun. And his role model, though, is Andy Warhol. He actually got to meet him one time. And this is a year in this Andy's life where he takes you through day by day what goes on in his life. It's wonderful. It's funny because when he drops names, he drops some names that you recognize and other ones he makes you guess. It's very irreverent. It's a lot of fun.
And he's evidently a late night icon.
A lot of people
have been thinking about David Letterman, who's just announced that he'll be leaving his show for good on May
20th. And they're thinking of
but here's
Andy Cohen.
Watch What Happens Live. So
right.
Stephen Colbert has got not just Jimmy Fallon to contend with, but he's got Andy Cohen.
And he's also on Morning Joe a lot, too.
Uh-huh.
So
he's
got a serious
side. All
right,
so The Andy Cohen Diaries, A Deep Look at a Shallow Year. And then you've got a cookbook for us to finish up. This is called Marcus Off Duties, Marcus Off Duty, rather, The Recipes That I Cook at Home by Marcus Samuelson.
And this is the award-winning chef, and he's a New York Times bestselling author as well. He has a wonderful restaurant in New York, in Harlem, called Red Rooster. He was born in Ethiopia, raised in Sweden, and trained in European kitchens and France. And this takes you not only through his favorite recipes, blending cultures, but also about his life and how he has traveled and what he brings to thinking about food and making food almost something that brings people together from different cultures and how you mix them. So it's a wonderful gift book. Beautifully illustrated, and some of the things you could actually, if you're not such a great cook, you could actually do.
You could do. So he makes it accessible for folks who aren't like gourmands.
Right. Right. He is really just a wonderful person, and his food is delicious.
Yeah, here's one of a ribeye on the bone and black pocket salmon grilled on a plank.
Coconut lime curry chicken, mac cheese and greens, and chocolate pie spice with Indian masala.
My Lord, who could turn that
down? I know.
All right, Marcus Off Duty, The Recipes That I Cook at Home by Marcus Samuelson. Well, Carla Hayden, happy holidays. Thank you. These are great recommendations for gifts and for a treat for ourselves as well.
Oh, I think so.
Appreciate it. Dr. Carla Hayden is the director of the Enoch Pratt Free Library. There's always lots going on there. Right now, for example, in the Central Library, there's an exhibition called Maurice Sendak, the Memorial Exhibition. It's a retrospective of 50 years of the work of Maurice Sendak, along with reactions and responses to that work by 50 different people. So go down and check that out, along with all the other things that they have going on at the Enoch Pratt Library. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Stick around. Lots more going on this morning.
It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Our theater critic, J. Wynn Russick, has been to see the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company's production of A Christmas Carol. She brings us this review.
Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, set in 1840s Baltimore. A clever idea. The Baltimore references start with the opening speech. The death certificate for Scrooge's partner Marley was signed by the Baltimore city clerk. Scrooge and Marley's business is on the corner of Calvert and German Streets. If you know that German Street is now Redwood, you'll realize this is the location of the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company, which has produced this brand new version of Dickens' classic. The men asking Scrooge for alms for the poor are architect Robert Carey Long and the future controversial Baltimore mayor, George William Brown.
I'm George William Brown, and this is my friend Robert Carey Long, an architect of some renown.
Very pleased to meet you, Mr. Scrooge.
Long, eh?
Yes, sir.
Didn't you build old St. Paul's?
That's right.
It's terrible. It's a terrible church. You're a terrible architect.
So, does a famous mid-19th century Baltimore businessman serve as Scrooge? Enoch Pratt, perhaps? Johns Hopkins? No, far too civic-minded and philanthropic. Ah, maybe John Work Garrett, president of the B&O Railroad. Nope. In director Ian Gallinar's adaptation, Scrooge is just Scrooge, the character Dickens created. The Baltimore references are more a matter of tinsel on the tree than the tree itself. The references give a sense of place. Scrooge lives on St. Paul Street. His clerk, Bob Cratchit, lives on Shakespeare Street in Fells Point. The actors who alternate as narrators fill in more details, particularly when Scrooge is escorted on tours of his past, present, and future by the ghosts who haunt him Christmas Eve.
Scrooge in the spirit passed through the city and watched it change and stood upon an open country road with fields on either hand. As they traveled, the city had entirely vanished. Washington Monument disappeared as fog does when it rises. Federal Hill dissolved into the moonlight. There was nothing to Baltimore, or its people, or its skyline.
But aside from snippets of local color, Gallinar's production doesn't deepen our knowledge of 1840s Baltimore or of Dickens' most famous work. Part of the problem is that, at least at the final preview I attended, Gregory Burgess portrays Scrooge with more bluster than insight. He bellows with outrage at the start of the play. He bellows with glee after he sees the light at the end of the play.
I don't know what to do! I'm as light as a feather! I'm as happy as an angel!
Truth is, Burgess's Scrooge never seems truly mean-spirited. In his jaunty knitted nightcap, he's almost adorable. His eventual change of heart, like the production's Baltimore trappings, feels more external than internal. There are other difficulties. The blocking suggests that Chesapeake Shakespeare is not yet fully acclimated to its beautiful new facility. Especially in the center section where I sat, theatergoers are often looking at actors' backs. And some of this adaptation's language is too modern. A poultry butcher is called the chicken guy. And at one point Scrooge says, "You've lost me there," to Daniel Flint's fine Ghost of Christmas Present. Laura Rocklin is lovely as the Ghost of Christmas Past. Her white gown suggests the bride Scrooge might have married if he hadn't traded love for greed. Molly Moores as Bob Cratchit's devoted wife and Tim R. Bintram as Jolly Fezziwig are also notable. But despite incorporating lots of Christmas music, Chesapeake Shakespeare's Christmas Carol is unlikely to strike a powerful chord with fans of Baltimore or Dickens. The theater company hopes this adaptation will become a holiday tradition. I'm not going to give it a bah humbug. Instead, I'll consider this an early draft with more work to be done.
Maryland Morning Theater critic J. Wynn Russick. A Christmas Carol continues at Chesapeake Shakespeare Company through December 23rd. I'm Sheila Cast. After the news, we explore the art of basketry. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Go to our website to learn more about the segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in on the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Let us consider the homely basket.
Time was, handmade baskets were commonplace, so common and utilitarian that they weren't really seen as cultural artifacts. They were just what you used to hold oysters or berries or vegetables. But that has changed. Now Maryland is home to the Center for Research in Basketry, which aims to keep the art of basketry alive in the Mid-Atlantic. Kathy Beauchesne, a retired Johns Hopkins administrator, is president and CEO of the center. She also just started a new basket-making supply shop, Charm City Baskets. Proceeds will support the center. And Kathy Beauchesne joins me in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sheila. Thank you for having me.
What drew you to basket making?
I would say the first thing that drew me to basket making was after my grandfather passed away, and I found an old oak basket on the basement steps. And it was a very beautiful basket. It was an apple basket. And so I picked it up and took it home. And I'd always loved baskets, but it wasn't until later on that I found a shop in Dickeyville where they taught basket making, and they also provided supplies and they brought in other teachers. And so I was very excited to be able to take that course. And once I took the first class there, I was really hooked on making baskets. And
what hooked you?
I think it was the weaving, and it's kind of an in and out kind of thing. I am a social worker, right? And so my job requires a lot of emotional energy. And so the actual act of creating something and of kind of weaving under and over, in and out, and creating an artistic piece using this particular kind of material was really what attracted me to it, I think.
Yeah, I should tell listeners that that apple basket
right.
from your grandfather's house is sitting between us here.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Here
it is.
In the studio, and it is beautiful. So I look at a basket like that, and about how long would it take someone who knows what she's doing to make that?
It would take a while, because particularly for the Day Basket Factory.
The Day Basket Factory is an historic factory,
yes,
in
right.
Northeast Maryland.
Right, exactly.
Since just after the Civil War. Right?
Right, exactly. They cut their own oak, all right? They prepare all this oak to weave. And so it takes a while. So first of all, they have to get the right tree, and the tree has to be an 8-foot section, about 8 inches in diameter, and the grain of the tree has to be straight. And so many times when you're making an oak basket like this at the Day Basket Factory, you may go through several trees before you find the right tree. And so the rest of it goes in the fireplace or, is
whatever other
yeah, whatever
other,
use.
What, right? What might be useful.
Right.
But the weaving part.
Uh-huh. And so the weaving part is also cut. And it probably takes, it would take me like about to make a basket of this size, which is a relatively small rectangular kind of basket, it would probably take about a half a day.
On 88.1, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Kathy Beauchesne. She's president and CEO of the Center for Research in Basketry in Maryland. We're talking about the art of basket making. In simplest terms, have the kinds of baskets made in Maryland changed over time?
Yes, they have. I think they have. These baskets that I brought, the eel pot is no longer made.
What is an eel pot? Sound like a basket.
It is. We have one here. And an eel pot is really a trap. It's just like a crab pot. And the purpose of an eel pot is to catch eels. And so they used to be made out of oak. And the watermen, when they made them themselves, they would use them in the spring, in the summer, in the fall. And then in the wintertime, they would repair them if they were broken. And so they have a funnel at one end and they have a plug at the other end, and the eels, they're baited and the eels swim in and then they're caught. And then today what happens is that the eel pots are made out of wire, and the eel pot industry is just huge, so that they're brought to the shore, kept live, and then a distributor comes every week and flies them across the country. And across the world. It's a global industry now.
So on your website, basketresearch.org, you write, quote, "In Maryland, we are losing our basket-making traditions and culture." Explain that.
Okay. I believe we're in a race to save this craft in Maryland. These baskets are no longer made. The traditions are lost. The basket makers have passed away. And I just think that, you know, that we need to find as many baskets as we can in Maryland. I belong to a basket guild in North Carolina, and there they have 23 basketry guilds in the state. In Maryland, we only have three. And it has been thought that the basketry in Maryland and in the mid-Atlantic states has was lost, just simply lost, because of the conflicts between the colonists and because the climate was not conducive to saving baskets that are made out of natural materials. So the heat and the humidity and the water, you know, just are very difficult. You know, it's very difficult to preserve baskets. And so anyway, so the baskets are in the museums, but I think they are in people's homes, and people have treasured them for years. And so those are the ones that we're trying to find in this project, as well as the ones in museums.
And so tell me if that's true, that the tradition is kind of shrinking. Is there really a market for the kind of shop that you've just opened, a supply shop for basket makers?
The basket making has had a resurgence in the last 30 years among contemporaries of mine and the younger generations. And so I teach classes, so I'm expecting that we will train a new generation of basket makers here in Baltimore. And I think that's very important because the shop where I learned originally closed in the 1980s, and an entire generation of basket makers, you know, was not trained here in Maryland. And so we're trying to also, you know, gather together the names and the locations of all the basket makers in Maryland. And I'm guessing there's probably maybe 200 total. And so we're trying to pull them all together so that we can, you know, form an association and really promote basket making, because we have, you know, we have waterman traditions, we have fishing traditions, we have Western Maryland traditions, which are kind of like West Virginia, Appalachian style traditions. We're affected by different cultures, and every single culture made baskets. So every single culture that came through or is in Maryland makes baskets of some sort. And so it's really important for us to kind of identify all of those baskets that are here now and then to promote new basket making in our state.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kathy Beauchesne is president and CEO of the Center for Research in Basketry, and she's just opened a basket-making supply shop, Charm City Baskets, in Baltimore's Highland Town. It's open afternoons, Thursdays through Saturdays. There's an exhibit of baskets from the Day Basket Company in Northeast that's up at Charm City Baskets through February. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. More of this interview there, too. Special thanks to Elizabeth Sherwood, who produced this segment. I'm Sheila Cast. This is 88.1. Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy.
We have production help from
Connor Graham,
Payam Agagasam,
and Elizabeth Sherwood.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
On this day in Maryland history, we checked our regular sources and couldn't find any memorable achievement. Dear lovers of history, if you know something we missed, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and send us a message. I'm Sheila Cast. Glad you've been listening. Back with you on Wednesday.